morning, church, and welcome to the Greenwood campus of Broadway United Methodist. If you're new to us, we are delighted to have you. I want to remind you that on the back of your bulletin is a place, a couple things there. There's a place to take some notes. God speaks to all of us, and God may say something to you that you want to remember and write down. And also keep in mind there are scriptures in your bulletin for Lent and scripture to read 5 days a week. So if you're not already in a Bible reading plan, I'd encourage you to take that up. Today we start a new message series. As Jeremy has mentioned, we enter this season that we in the Christian church across the world call Lent. Began last Wednesday, and what we call Ash Wednesday, and goes for 40 days, excluding the Sundays. So it's a time where we really reflect on our relationship with God, do some personal examination in light of who Jesus was and all that he has done for us, his sacrifice. But what we're doing in this series, particularly, we begin a new series, as you notice, called Eyewitness. But what we're really doing today is entering, and each week over the next 6 weeks, we're entering the Passion story ourselves. We're going to do that by looking at some of the lesser known figures of this story. Usually, when you get to this place of the story in Jesus, we talk about people like Judas, who betrayed Jesus. And most of us probably heard of Jesus and know something about him. We talk about Peter, and when Jesus was on trial and Jesus needed a friend, Peter was the one who didn't stand up for Jesus and denied that he had ever known him, and then went out and really just wept like a baby. And we remember these folks that are in the story and play a big role, but we are not always aware of those that have a smaller role. And so this is called Eyewitness, but it's kind of the smaller figures in the story. For example, we're going to talk in a few weeks about Simon of Cyrene. I bet you may have heard that name, but I bet if we had to go around with a microphone and get you to tell us about Simon of Cyrene, it'd be pretty hard-pressed to do that, and it would be for me before this series. So don't feel alone in that. But he is this guy that plays this really important role. When Jesus physically can no longer carry his cross, Simon is pressed into service to carry Jesus' cross on part of that journey. And then there's Joseph of Arimathea. Joseph of Arimathea was a very wealthy man who was sort of a secret disciple who eventually came around, literally at the cross, came around to the fact that Jesus was the Son of God. And he's the one who actually physically takes Jesus' body down from the cross. Imagine handling, it's one thing to imagine being there, but imagine handling the body of Jesus. That's what Joseph of Arimathea did. We're going to talk about how we can look at the cross through his eyes. And this morning we begin with Caiaphas. Now he's somewhat known, but not as well known as some of these others like Judas and Peter and Pilate. We know quite a bit about him. But the truth is, when you read through the Gospels, first of all, Caiaphas is in all four Gospels. And when you get behind the story of the cross, you know, we sort of think of Pilate because he was the Roman governor who had to make a decision. And so we think, well, Pilate was the one who put Jesus on the cross. But, you know, Pilate sort of waffled around. He said, well, I'm not sure this guy deserves this. But underneath the story, there's one man who consistently believed that Jesus needed to die, and it was Caiaphas, the high priest. This man who was given this most important role as a spiritual leader of God's people is the one all the facts point to as being the one that decided, before there was even a trial, that Jesus needed to be put to death. So, when you follow the money of the story, you know, if you want to know what's going on in a story, follow the money and the power, right? And that tells you a lot. When you follow the money and you follow the deception and the calculated actions, the person at the source of all that is the same man, this man Caiaphas. So who was a high priest and what did they do? Let's get to know him a little bit and certainly his role. The high priest was at the top of the religious org chart. You know, whatever that religious org chart is, you know, like at Broadway, we have Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Then we have our senior pastor. Then we have the pastor at Greenwood, you know, that kind of thing. No. The religious org chart of their life was God, the temple, and then the high priest. So this was a man that was to represent God to God's people at every level. That started 500 years before Jesus. When the Israelites, who'd been in Babylonian captivity, in exile, they were ripped away from their land by this foreign power, when they come back to Jerusalem, back to Palestine, they no longer have a king. And so the high priest became this religious, quasi-political leader. because they lived in Roman territory, right? Even when they were back in their homeland and no longer exiles. And so somebody had to kind of negotiate, or somebody had to know the ways of Rome and have political connections there, and it was the high priest, because Rome was the occupying government. Also, starting after the Babylonian exile, the people rebuilt the temple. Now, this was huge for them. Their social life, their spiritual life, their relational life, all centered, their family life, all centered around the temple, their cultural life, all of that. And at the center of the temple life, there were priests, and there were a lot of them. And then in the center of the priest was the high priest. So Caiaphas played this very large spiritual role. And it wasn't just that he did for a few years, his whole family for 50 years. He was the sixth high priest within his own family. So in the workplace now, we call that what? Nepotism, right? I heard that this week a lot of people were looking up the word recuse. That's what I heard. So I just heard that. Said everybody was going and looking that word up. So you might want to look up nepotism at some point. You probably know what that is. But anyway, he had been in this a long time. Everything about him represented the purity and righteousness and holiness of God. Even what he wore, the priests all had four garments that they wore in common. But the high priest had four extra garments. So if you're thinking about like getting me a birthday present for my August birthday, you might make me one of these things. That would be really cool. And so while the priest had these four things that were in common, there were four unique to the office of the high priest. One was a robe that was blue and purple. And then it had scarlet tassels. So it was really a dynamic, it was way beyond a light blue shirt and black pants. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it was something dynamic. And when he put it on, man, people knew his role. And then he had a vest. And the vest was decorated with precious stones, 12 of them, to represent the 12 tribes of Israel. And then beside that, he had a breastplate with 12 precious gems. And then he wore a turban, and I guess this is the one thing you could get me. I like this. He had a turban that had a gold plate on it that said, "Holiness unto God." Now imagine the look. I mean, he represented everything God's people wanted and knew about God. That God was their leader. God had led them out of slavery. They didn't have the power to break out of the Babylonian power. Or Egyptian power, if you go all the way back to their story where they're crossing the Red Sea, God had delivered them. And this man was the center of that. So, you see throughout the Gospels that this man keeps forgetting what his role is, forgetting that it's not about him, forgetting his primary representation in the community. Not only did he do this for his family for 50 years, and he was the sixth in the family, but his family over the years developed they became wealthy off the temple tax. Now, in the Old Testament law, it was required, if you were a good Jew, when you came to the temple, which once a year everybody was required to do, no matter how far away you lived, and others came literally weekly, but every year everyone had to come, everyone that was Jewish, at least once a year. And so what they did, you had to come and make sacrifices. So there was a temple tax. Now that was okay. That was set up in the Old Testament. And there was a certain amount of money you actually gave. And then you brought other sacrifices, right? Like you could bring a lamb to be sacrificed. And then you brought other gifts to the priest, meat and bread. And that was all prescribed and all okay. But what they decided to do over the years, the priest decided to really make this thing financially beneficial for them. And so you might come with a lamb, but they had to inspect it. That was also in the law. But where they go beyond is they then charge for inspecting your lamb to say, no, this is a pure lamb. It can be sacrificed and is worthy of an offering to God. And they benefited off that. And then they placed money changers out in the temple court before you get into the actual temple, because people came from all kinds of places and needed to exchange their money. And so they had kind of what I would call human AMT machines. You would go up and you would say, this is your money from my providence, and they would charge you 12 to 13%. You thought $2 was bad when you used your credit card, not with your bank. I mean, this is the invention. Listen, banks didn't invent hidden fees. I think this is where it began, right here. And it was all to benefit themselves. So Caiaphas, who has this critical spiritual role in the life of his people, I think gradually drifted way away from that into a life of power and influence and comfort. And throughout the Gospels, you see signs of the corruption and the power that actually led Jesus to be put on the cross. I mean, scholars are pretty much agreed that when Jesus went in and turned over the money changers' tables and got angry and ran them off, that was the point when many of the leaders decided Jesus had to go. And then there's the trial of Jesus. Jesus is arrested. He's put on trial by the high priest. But it wasn't a trial, really. They had prescribed rules to follow, as we do in our land. They violated those. They created witnesses, false witnesses that couldn't agree when it came time to tell their story. They held the trial at night. It was required by the Jewish law that it was a two-day trial, and the sentence could only be given on the second day, the final decision. They did this at night. It was prescribed that it was held in a special chamber set aside in the temple for a trial. They did this at Caiaphas' house. So Caiaphas invites the homeboys over to his place in order to, quote, have this trial. Now, maybe the clearest picture we get of how corrupt Caiaphas was is in John chapter 11. This is before Jesus is even arrested. A good amount of time before Jesus is even arrested. And here's what the Gospel of John tells us in chapter 11. Now, Jesus has been getting attention, his teaching, his miracles, the crowds following him. And before his arrest, here's what it said. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. What are we accomplishing, they ask. Here is this man performing many signs. If we let him go on this, everybody will believe in him. And then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. Then one of them named Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year, spoke up. You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than the whole nation to perish. It's better for one man to die. Capital punishment, murder, ahead of Jesus even being arrested. A verdict was decided. So here's my question. How could things go so wrong? And how can things get so off base in a person's life? And how can it happen to us? Well, maybe not to that degree. And I got to thinking, I just wondered if we could get inside of Caiaphas' mind and listen to him for a few minutes, what it would really sound like, the self-talk, what he was really saying to himself. So for a few minutes, let's just imagine. You see, one of these great gifts God has given us of our imagination, and try and imagine what that dialogue was.
I'm in control here. I've worked tirelessly, sacrificing relationships with family, friends, and loved ones to be at the center of all religious activity in Jerusalem, to have the say of what loving God looks like, what loving God means, what it means to be a Jew. I am important, and without me, this would all fall apart. These people need me. The ministry I have been building, creating, and pouring my life into will not be ruined by one man. I am determined to fight to the bitter end and will do whatever it takes to win. If I lose my seat as high priest in Jerusalem, surely I will be found out. People will see me for who I am and what I am. I am scared to death. I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days. Is that actually what he said? I mean, I never really asked him, but that's what I heard he said. I am the Messiah, the Son of God. Really? No way. Not today. Not while I'm in control. Not while I have everyone's support, allegiance, fear, and money. People love me. These people in Jerusalem must fear me, and they must respect me. Who do I know that will testify and say that all he has been saying is hearsay? Who can I manipulate into making a claim that's plausibly true? You know what? It doesn't matter at this point. I can't lose this thing. I have to win. Oh, I'll make a fool of myself for sure. I'll put on one heck of a drama. I'll even pretend like I care. I'll even cry and tear my clothes. Is he lying, though? The things that have been happening, people seeing, walking, running, some for the very first time, evil spirits and demons leaving bodies, the weather, the water. Only God can do these things, right? The scriptures say, oh, it doesn't matter. I have to regain control. I, High Priest Caiaphas, will see you in court, Jesus.
Wow. I wonder if that wasn't pretty close to the way this man was thinking. So here's my question. How did it come to that? How did he get to that place? How did this man get so far from what he should have been? And then this question, can it happen to us? Maybe not to that extreme. The question I think each of us have to answer is, what is it that's driving my life? I think that's at the core of Caiaphas. And I think the issue is, it's so easy for all of us to forget the main thing, to let it slip off the table, and then worry and fear takes over, and we start trying to control things that we can't really control, and our anxiety goes up. Over time, it's easy for our lives to become more and more driven by our own desires, by ourselves, by our money, our power, or to be driven by fear and anxiety. It's not easy to keep the main thing in our lives, with so much coming at us. Constant information, constant demands, constant things that could well raise our anxiety level. One of my good friends is a guy by the name of Eddie Fox. He was a Eastern Kentucky preacher who went on to be a great leader in the United Methodist Church and became a world traveler, really. One time I heard him tell this story about he had, at that time, he had 2 4-year-old twin sons. And Eddie is from Nashville, Tennessee. And so while I'm allergic to orange, basically, I still like people from Tennessee. And he's one of them. And so he said what he did for their fourth Christmas was he got them full regalia of Tennessee football uniforms. I mean, helmets, shoulder pads, the pants, the knee pads, the whole thing. And on Christmas morning, they were excited. And here were these four-year-old twins. Man, they were decked out in their Tennessee outfits, had all the stuff on. They were ready. He said their heads were so small, if they turned around fast, they'd be looking out the ear hole. And they were ready to go play. And they said, Dad, where's the football? And Eddie Fox remembered that he had forgot something. In a way, the main thing, you can have all the equipment, but if you don't have the ball, you don't have the main thing. Caiaphas, the high priest, the main spiritual leader, forgot the main thing. You know what? His job and your job and my job are the same, really. What is the main thing? I think the main thing is to stay connected to God. Just to stay connected, to stay in relationship, to continue to grow in our faith and love God. Not trying to keep a list of rules, not trying to impress someone else, not trying to manage our image, but trying to just walk with God. When I got out of seminary in 1980, I was appointed. My first appointment full-time back in Kentucky was that year, and I was appointed to Memorial United Methodist in Elizabethtown, Kentucky, a large church, and I was the associate pastor, and I loved my role there. I loved those 3 years. They just built a brand new gym, and so I could work all day, and then I could go put on my sweatsuit and go back and stay till 10 o'clock at night playing basketball and hanging out with the youth. I was in charge of the youth ministry there. And, I mean, I was going all the time, and I loved it. No one had to make me. And I'll never forget, we had a guest preacher in, and a well-known Methodist pastor, real well-known in the nation. And I was, like, privileged to get to meet him. And on the first night of the service, I met in the senior pastor's office, and I met Dr. So-and-so and introduced myself. And I started telling him. He asked about me, and I started telling him about all the things I was doing. I was leading studies. I was taking youth on mission trips. I was coming back at night and playing basketball. And he listened so graciously. I really wasn't bragging. I was just excited But I got one of the best pieces of wisdom I've ever received in my whole ministry. He listened to me. He joined in. And then finally said, Rick, that's great. But I want you to remember one thing. That working for God is no substitute for walking with God. Wow. Caiaphas somewhere lost it. We can be around spiritual things, and we can be in Bible studies, and we can be serving, and we can be coming to church, but not necessarily living out of the richness of a relationship that is personal and real with Christ. Lent is a time of doing some self-examination. So again, I want to ask the question, who or what is driving your life? I believe Caiaphas slowly drifted. His desires at one point were good, but then he started leaning into his image and his power and anxiety and stress and worry and trying to control it all, and he got off track. During Lent, we sometimes give up something. Is anybody giving up something during Lent? You've given up something? What are you giving up? That's awesome. If you can give up that caffeine, I'm telling you. Somebody else, what are you giving up? Chocolate. Oh, my gosh, that's a hard one. Yeah, I think that's a great thing. It helps you kind of reflect, you know, when you want the mellow yellow, you want the chocolate. Oh, y'all could get together and really be, man, you could be lit up on the. It reminds you of no, this season is about God making a much greater sacrifice, but my small sacrifice reminds me of that. I think that's awesome. Kudos to you two. And I'm sure others of you are too timid to raise your hand. That's fine. You're doing good stuff. I've decided this year to not so much give up something, but to try and take on something with the help of God. And it really grows out of my study this week, reflecting on, okay, God, what? And here's what I've come up with. This may seem odd, but maybe you'll get it when I wrap this up here in a couple minutes. What I'm wanting to do is to be more of a non-anxious presence. Has anybody noticed there's a lot of anxiety out there in our world today? When I look at Caiaphas, I see a man who is constantly anxious, just as Evan read for us, trying to control, thinking about his image, thinking about his power, not reflecting at all on God. What do you want in my home? What do you want in my work? What do you want? How am I to live in relationship to someone who's against me at this state? You know, whatever it is. And when I look at Jesus, what I see, he's the one on trial. He's the one who's about to be crucified, and he is an utterly non-anxious presence. Well, I've got a long way to go, but my goal during Lent is to be that. You work in places where there's a lot of anxiety. And I believe people look to a person who's fully aware of the problem. This is not, you know, I pretend like the problems aren't there. No, no, no. Who fully grasps the anxiety that's going on, the worries, the fears that are out there, but chooses to live by the power of God's Spirit as a non-anxious presence. I'm telling you, those folks are a magnet in offices today and in schools and in our neighborhoods. Someone who is a realist about issues and yet is a non-anxious presence. Caiaphas was so anxious, and you see the contrast in Jesus. Every one of us in here would probably be healthier if we had less fear and less worry, less stress. And you don't get rid of stress so much by paring down your schedule. I mean, maybe you could, but it's really by learning to live a certain way. How is that? That we trust and walk with God every day. God, before I go out today, you're with me. You're in me. And we really do trust that God is with us. It's so easy to go, you know, God, where are you? I'm not sure you really care about me. I'll close with this story. When our daughter Sarah was 2 years old, she did not like to go to bed at night. Now, we're pretty clear, pretty gentle, but direct with raising our children, and I found that, you know, if you're confident and the rules are clear, you know kids will follow. I mean, that's it. Not always, not perfectly. And Sarah just couldn't, if there was a party going on, if two people were still up, if the television was on, she just is such an extrovert, she just had to know what was going on. Now, our younger daughter, Anna, by the time she was 7, we'd look around 8 o'clock at night and go, where's Anna? She'd put herself to bed. She was asleep. That was a blessing. But Sarah, if you were awake, she just simply wanted to be with you. So we'd put her down in her bed. You know, this went on for months. She knew she couldn't get up. She wouldn't do that. But she just would not go to sleep. We'd rock her. I don't know if you've had this experience as a parent, where you're trying to get one to sleep, and you got them in the crib, and you're patting them on the back, you know, and you're like patting them on the, and then you're letting off the pressure a little bit, and then you're going to sneak out of the room, and the floor creaks, you know. Anybody done that? Yeah. That was Sarah. She wanted, if you were up, she wanted to be up. And so finally, Debbie and I said, okay, we can't, you know, we didn't play into the, I want a drink of water. We do all that ahead of time, okay? Here's your water, here's your drink, blah, blah, blah. Stay in bed. She would stay in bed, but not go to sleep. And so finally one night we said, well, this is the night. We're not getting up. We're not, so Debbie and I go to bed, and we're like, no matter, you know, she cries. That's fine. And so we got in bed, and, you know, she wasn't asleep, and she was staying within the boundaries. She could make some noise, but not too much. And then finally she's crying. Now, as a parent, when your child starts crying, you know when they get that cry where you're not even there, but you know their bottom jaw is quivering? You know what I'm talking about? And we just kept, no, we're not getting up. And Debbie'd start to get up, and I'd kind of hold her down. And I'd start to get up, and she'd hold me down. And finally there was this long pause, and we go, oh, my gosh, we're victorious. We're awesome parents. She's asleep. And after about 30 seconds, there was this little bitty voice, this little quivering chin that said, Mommy, Daddy, remember me? No, honey, we forgot about you. You were quiet 30 seconds. We were going out to dinner tonight. I think that cry is what can happen to us. And therefore, we lose our non-anxious presence because we're like, I got to figure this out by myself. Now, we have a role and a responsibility that only we can play, but I think of it as being in partnership, in concert with God, walking with God, walking through whatever you're going through because you're not alone. Like no parent can forget their child, God cannot forget you. Can't do it. And so when we call out, He's there. So that we can live out that non-anxious presence in a world that needs that witness. Would you bow your head for just a minute? Just for about 2 minutes, I want to, just with your head bowed and eyes closed, I want to walk you through a little experiment. For a moment, imagine not being afraid anymore. Imagine facing financial difficulties or an irate boss with inner poise and resolve. Imagine receiving bad news and generating constructive ways to solve the problem rather than spiraling through worst case scenarios. Imagine facing rejection and obstacles without giving in to discouragement. Imagine acknowledging mistakes you've made, moving confidently into the future. Imagine doing all of this with God as your partner and your friend. Now imagine the people around you coming to you when they're upset or discouraged because they find that your peace of mind is contagious. The mind controlled by the Spirit is life and peace. And what you are imagining in your mind is being immersed in the Spirit's flow. This is the phrase that wonderfully describes the role of the Spirit and that the Spirit wants to play in our minds. The Spirit is a non-anxious presence. Would you just silently say that? Lord, your Spirit is a non-anxious presence. Lord, fill us with your presence that we may not drift as we've seen in the Scripture today. And when we have, that we would be by your Spirit pulled back in to walking with you by trusting you and knowing you never forget us. You are our Father. Come and draw us closer to you in these days of Lent. In Jesus' name, amen.